Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Giant Fork and Spoon. I'm your hostess, Chef Elena Alexander. No reservations are needed to be seated in our Word Cafe. It is here where we are serving up lots of hot topics about my favorite subject, food. Please subscribe to our channel as we continue to put more dishes on the podcast buffet. Our companion blog, giantforkandspoon.blogspot.com, is also available to view and subscribe. Our conversations here are sure to entice your palate, awaken your curiosity, titillate your intellect, and satisfy your cravings for food for thought. We will talk to foodies, chefs, culinary educators, and just about anybody who loves food. So let's get you seated and get ready for today's Blue Plate Special.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Chef Elena. We're going to do something a little different today than we've had done in previous episodes. My big brother will be joining us shortly as our co-host. And we'll get him up and running, and then we'll get live with our guest of the day, chef and educator, Chef David Blackman. I'm not currently seeing them online, so I'm going to, while we're talking, give them a little jingle on the text message kind of thing so that they may join us. While we're waiting, I want to go ahead and tell you a couple of new things that are floating around with myself and with our neighborhood kind of place around in Chicago. As a lot of people know, a lot of violence happens in our city. And right now, two of the populations that I teach are consistently being impacted by that level of violence. I'm hoping to have that as one of our subjects of today. And let me see if I can get our guest and our co-host in at the same time. A little technical difficulty here. I'm sure it will get resolved quickly. Bear with me just a moment. All right. Let's see, where did Mr. Blackman go? All right, so Mr. Blackman has a large pedigree. I can't wait to get him on here. See if we can get this happening. We are live broadcasting. This is always the danger of being live and on air at the same time. Hey, can I get you to call in at 657-383-0717. And that also goes for our listening audience. If anyone wants to call in, that is our guest call-in number, 657-383-0717. All right, got a hold of one of our guests. Let me find out where my big brother is, other than, you know, in the city of Atlanta where he resides. And we'll see if we can get that going as well. All right. What is happening today? I tried going live yesterday as well and had a little bit of a problem. Hopefully, it won't be that way today. Let's see what's going on. Calling him on from the landline, see if we can get my brother in. Hey, big brother, let me get you on live. The broadcast has already begun. Host call in. I'm sorry, guest call in, 657-383-0717. I'm also having difficulty getting our guest in at the moment, but we'll get that going, I'm sure. All righty. This is always a risk when you're doing something live. Always a little bit of a hiccup every now and then. And I don't want to take us offline and tape it. Like, that's what I had to do yesterday. For today, let's see if we can make a little extra effort to get this going. All set? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let me see if I can get you on my screen. Go ahead and dial that number for me. Yes. 657-383-0717. Well, all righty. Not showing up. All right, so what to do? Working hard. All right. Hopefully the topics that we're going to cover today include information about the CPS schools. Hello.
Hey, I called the 657-383-0517 number, and it says there's no show scheduled, and it hangs up on me.
It's 0717.
0717. Hey, okay. 0717.
Okay. Cool. All righty. Looks like we're making a little bit of progress. Just bear with us for a second. I would hate to leave you with too much dead air. For those of you who are in the area and understand what is happening with our Chicago public school system, our teachers have been working without a contract for a little while, and there are lots of negotiations going on, and we are hoping everything will come out for the best for all parties. However, we have a brand new governor Governor Rauner is a Republican, and we're not entirely sure, at least I'm not entirely sure, that it's going to be the safest, the best way to go coming up, the way he would like to see the changes that he's proposing in our public education system. What is happening? I've never had quite so much problems getting in my guests. Let me try something I've not done before. Let's go, and I'm going to try to call them directly, see if that works. Phone logs. 678. Awesome. I see we got one number showing up. Good afternoon.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Awesome. Yay. We got our guest of honor today. And I'm still working on getting my co-host, my big brother in culinary. Let's see. Can you dial his number to see if this will work? We're getting there. So while we are live on air and getting a little bit closer to the way we wanted it to be.
Hello?
Big brother right there? Awesome. There we go. Now we can start in earnest. Sorry about that, but, you know, live and it has its drawbacks. All righty. First and foremost, welcome to Big Giant Fork and Spoon. Our guest today is Chef David Blackman, who has a great big long title on his business card to indicate what it is that he does for our Chicago public school system. And I'm going to allow our guest to explain all that he does while he introduces himself. Go ahead, Mr. Blackman.
Good afternoon, everybody out there. My name is Chef David Blackman. I am the program director of the Education to Career Programs in Chicago Public Schools. I run not just culinary arts, but agriculture science programs, the automobile technology programs, auto collision, diesel technology, welding, supply chain demand, and manufacturing programs for the school district. We have programs in about 58 high schools around the city of Chicago, They're hands-on programs, three-year programs in which students are enrolled in their sophomore year through senior year. They earn industry-level certifications, build out their resumes. We give out millions of dollars in scholarships, and a lot of students also get jobs. I run these programs as a solution. Not a lot of people are going to go to college when they leave high school. Not a lot of people can afford college, and that's just the honest-to-God truth. We have to start giving our youth and our future of this country skilled hands to be able to be, you know, to work in the labor market. So that is what the CTE programs are about in Chicago Public Schools. I run 12 of them, but there's 46 different career pathways in the school system total. So, prior to that, I've been a chef for 25 years, so I know what it was like to be in a Chicago public high school and, you know, not really want to go straight into college. I went into a trade school and got my training first, and then I went on to college. But, you know, with that and armed with a degree, I felt more empowered that I was able to do anything I wanted to do, and that's what I try to give to our children.
Beautiful. Okay. That's exactly why I was so excited that you agreed to come on, because in the world of mentoring and youth education, you have a very pivotal role, and you're directly responsible for getting me into a teaching program, which I had not been able to do on my own. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks. My pleasure.
Awesome. You mentioned that you attended Chicago Public Schools. Which one did you attend, or which one?
I went to Burnside Scholastic Academy. That was my elementary school. And then I went to Lindblom Technical High School. It's not Lindblom Math and Science now, but, you know, still Lindblom to me.
And, exactly.
That's the schools I went to.
Dear brother, tell us a little bit about yourself. This is the first time you're getting to co-host with me, and I want my audience to get a little, you know, get a little taste of who my big brother is.
Okay. Well, my name is Alan Barnes, and I am originally from Chicago, born, bred, and raised on the south side of Chicago. Came out of, 122nd of Michigan, basically, is where I grew up at. I'm a Cook County baby. I went to Mendel Catholic High School. That's where I graduated from. But I attended the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana for 3 years, dropped out, then moved here to Atlanta, went to culinary arts school here in Atlanta, finished that in 96, and went on a run of doing culinary arts. I've gone all the way from the top managed to work my way all the way up to an executive chef's position, an executive sous chef's position, and so forth. Ran my own catering business for a little while, and dropped out for a minute. Now I'm back in it, starting over again, probably some would say from the bottom, but that's fine. That's pretty much about it. I also have two children, beautiful children, and a wife, married. My kids are attending Georgia State and Georgia DeKalb Tech here in Atlanta. One studying to be a professor of African American Studies, and the other one is going for a degree in robotics engineering. That's my son. So that's pretty much a little bit about me.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Great. I've always been so very proud of my niece and nephew. Just to throw that in there. Okay. So all three of us have strong food backgrounds, strong family backgrounds, and strong Chicago roots. Chef David, tell us, if you can, what is your first food memory?
My first food memory, wow. I would say that My grandmother used to make fried corn, and she used to always make extra fried corn for me. I didn't eat too much else, so we go to Hammond, Indiana for Thanksgiving, and I would have, like, my own fried corn just for me. She would have a 2-quart pot, And I would eat nothing but that. Now, mind you, it probably wasn't good for me. You know, I'd probably be a much stealthier brother if I'd eat all that delicious butter and brown sugar, onions, peppers, and corn, just, you know, bacon drippings, all in there. But that is my biggest food memory. What I think about when I think about something, it's just I could not wait to get over there, you know, for that. Another big food memory is just waking up on a holiday morning and smelling my mom's cooking, you know, smelling that trinity of peppers, onions, and celery, just whatever it was doing that's going to go to the dressing, and that roasted turkey or roast beef that's sitting in the oven slowly doing its thing but permeating the house with so much savoriness, you know, makes your mouth water. And those are my big food memories. Third,
nice.
When I went to culinary school to probably learn how to sear, the sound when that protein first hits the pan always makes me go wow. Just that, I love that sound, and those are my biggest food memories.
Awesome,
you know? Wow, nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Part of the reason why I formed this podcast the way that I did, and its companion blog, is I remember I was born in 1970, and I remember as a small child you would go visit people. And a lot of folks had the big giant fork and spoon hanging on the wall. No longer, you know, idea. Nobody really does that anymore. But that was just something to me, like, you know, A, I'm visiting. So most of the time, you know, somebody's going to put a plate in front of you when you're a visitor. But I would always see the giant fork and spoon. And I was a little fascinated by that. Like, is it a giant living here? Like, what is the deal? What does it mean? And I don't think anybody really knows what it means.
You know, when you first sent me the invitation to join your podcast and you told me the title of it, I cracked up because I got it immediately. And
yay!
I've been wanting a giant fork and spoon in my man cave just to have it. I've been looking online to see if anybody sells any giant wooden forks and spoons, you know. A giant wooden fork and spoon also matches that felt painting of Martin Luther King and Kennedy that you normally saw at someone's house. You know, John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Now they're probably going to have what? John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Barack Obama paintings next. But I always remember seeing that picture. Yeah. And a giant wooden fork and spoon. So I got it, and I was tickled pink when I saw the title. I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah, I understood it, too. I caught it myself. And what's interesting is that I'd like to do woodworking as like a side hobby. And one of the woodworking things that I've taken on is to actually make my own giant fork and spoon for my house, along with a giant knife as well. So far, I just got the design on the wood, so I haven't got a chance to cut them out. But that's one of the things I plan on working on.
Cool.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to probably launch a couple of woodworking or carpentry programs in the school district so I can get my own wooden fork and spoon. I think that's what I'm about to do. That's the next thing I'm going to open up is some, you know, bring back woodworking programs to CPS.
Yeah, man.
That'd be cool.
I think it was either my seventh or my eighth grade year. I took woodworking or wood shop, as they called it, and I really dug it. It was fun.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah. But, you know, it's quite interesting because chefs are pretty much artists in a respect. And I dabbled in painting and art and charcoal drawings and all of that growing up as well. And woodworking was a way, too. But the culinary arts, the baking and the pastry and just the creating of the plate presentations is what really, to me, is the artistic funness, if that's a way of putting it, that I like, that just really captivated me a lot of what I like to do, especially when I was in culinary school, was being able to put a picture on a plate and just paint it that way with sauces and with the foods and the colors. And it really works to me. That really sung to me.
Yeah. I try to engage, today's youth, you know, they're very engaged in different ways. A lot of it is, you know, very or rap tinged or something. Mm-hmm. So I basically tell kids that, you know, when I became a chef, to me it's like chicken wings. Chicken wings, that's my baseline. The sauce or whatever I'm putting on that wing, That's my 16 bars. And so it's like I'm like a rap artist. I'm Kanye West. And so then when you eat that chicken, you then nodding your head going, oh, man, this is delicious. I put that tune in your head. I'm touching your stomach. So to me it's like being a rap artist or you're doing that guitar solo, music on the plate, so to speak. So, you know, I'm not a great singer. I'm not a great dancer, but I can do something with the protein and some things from a cupboard and make something that makes people's heads nod. And I tell kids like that, you can move the crowd with certain food items. And that's how I try to get them engaged. You know, you become popular like you got the microphone in your hand. So kids kind of like that.
Yeah, because that is very interesting looking at it. Because for me, I guess in my age group, well, not my age group, but for me personally, it's more like a Picasso or a Monet or a Rembrandt is how I see myself, as opposed to, you know, like you say, touching the youth, because we do have to reach out to them. But it as touching them, and you use rap music as a way. And that is cool, because you can also introduce them into the classical music, into the classical arts, through culinary as well, with the way that you're putting it.
Correct. So, I mean, you know, building on flavors is like building a beat, putting a beat together. And listening to the lyrics and then doing the remix, you know. So I try to explain to them, but, you know, now keep that beat consistent and then do that 300 times, you know, something like that. So that's
yeah.
what I try to do.
Yeah, for me, I had to reach back a little bit, because since most of my professional work outside of teaching has been in pastry for the last maybe 12 years, it's so temporary a medium that I had to reach back and learn some of the stuff that I had forgotten about photography and how my grandfather had his own darkroom and the eye for look and composition of a photograph, because my art is going to disappear in 3, 2, 1. It's gone. So I had to relearn how to take photographs in a way to preserve the art that I was creating.
Wow, yeah, take pictures of your food. That's one thing that I do wish I've done, because I think about a lot of times you spend blood, sweat, and tears and wish that I had kept a camera in the kitchen to take a picture of something. And then, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
It's a food memory. People say, remember when you did blah, blah, blah? And sometimes I'm like, no, I don't remember that anymore. Oh, my God, I'm old. You know, but that one person tells me, they will tell me, I remember it, man. It was like this, that, and the other. And you had a syringe filled with sauce that was stuck in the side. And I was like, okay. I did that. Are you sure? I did that?
Right.
Really?
Sure,
you know, yeah, you sure?
Yeah.
Me, so, you know, must have been one of those nights I was on Vicodin, you know.
Yeah, Vicodin. It's kind of like, too, sometimes they ask you, do you remember you doing something? I'm like, nah. No, I don't have a clue. Are you sure that was me? Oh, yeah, no, I remember you did that, and it was just one of the greatest things I've ever tasted, and I'm just like, wow, I think I was just putting something together because I was in a rush. That's what's going through my head. So I don't really remember that, you know, or like when people say, can you give me the recipe for that? And you're like, wow, I was just like putting something together in the back at the last minute, and now you want a recipe. Okay,
well,
let me come up with something.
Yeah, that's actually a pet peeve of mine when people ask me for a recipe. It's like, am I not busy enough? You want me to stop what I'm doing right now to write down a recipe for? You know how much I had to pay to go to culinary school? You
okay.
Know, God, I want to say, listen, get a piece of paper and a pencil. You can sit down. I can talk. You can write it down. I can give you an idea what I think the measurement was. But I'm not going to stop so I can put together a recipe for, not unless you're going to pay me. Now, if you want to pay me, sometimes I feel that way. I mean, on one part, I feel it's a God-given gift, and I wouldn't mind wanting to share the recipe with you. It's just that I don't have time. And lately, I've been finding it kind of rude when people ask me to stop what I'm doing or when they want me to give them a recipe. Hey, I got a chicken. Give me a recipe. I'm like, you got an iPhone? Search on the web for a recipe.
Come on. We are no longer dealing with the little Dewey Decimal System and the little file cards and having to go look something up. It's right in your pocket.
Yes.
That's true.
Yeah, they don't know how good they have it. I tell kids about the Dewey Decimal System and the card catalog and how evil it was. It gave me false dreams when I thought the book might be there and it's not. But
oh,
now
definitely.
I download the book. Right, they can put on their iPad. I said, there should be no reason why you shouldn't know who Marcus Garvey is. There should be no reason, you know, he wasn't a baseball player. There should be no reason why, you know. So I go over that with my students all the time. Like, I see all the technologies you guys got in your pockets. So when I ask a simple question that's doing with something society, I expect the answer by the end of the class period because they all have cell phones. So, yeah, I got that.
Yeah. See, I tell the younger youth now, I say, man, the world is your oyster. I mean, really, literally, the world is your oyster. Everything you need to know is at the tip of your fingertips. And all you have to do is just learn how to stroll, and you can find out any information. There's no reason for you not to know anything. There's no reason, you know, like I told my kids, there's no reason for you to tell me I don't know.
Yep.
There's no reason for you to tell me that. Figure it out. You know, and then you come tell me something I don't know. You know, see, my grandmother, I love my mama's mother to death because she was like, there's no reason for you not to know anything. Now, this is back in the newspaper era. This woman would read two or three different newspapers a day. My father's father was the same way. He would read that newspaper every day. And I was like, why are you reading so many different newspapers? She said, because the best way to formulate an opinion is to read everybody else's different opinion and then formulate your own. She said, when you find something you want to learn about, she said, you read the positive side, you read the negative side, and then you formulate your own opinion based upon what you read. She said, but you have to read more than one person's opinion to get an opinion for yourself. She said, just don't take somebody says. Don't take what somebody says. She said, read both sides of it. And see, my grandmother, my mother's mother, she could argue the pros and cons of just about anything. Just about anything, she could argue the pros and cons of it. And she would do that just to challenge me and others, you know. And I want to tell you my earliest food-related memories. Because nobody asked me, and I want my 2 cents in on that.
I
got a couple, and the first one, I have to give it to my father. My father is one of my earliest food memories, and it was one day after Thanksgiving. Now, I don't remember the Thanksgiving dinner, all right? But I remember waking up the next morning and coming into the kitchen, and my dad is sitting. We were in an apartment in Parkway Gardens, and I remember my dad took the ham, he took some of the turkey, he took some onions, some green bell pepper, and he was sauteing all of that into a pan together. And I was like, Pops, what are you doing? He's like, I'm making eggs. And I'm like, wow, you making eggs for us? He's like, yep. So he put the eggs in on it, he threw some cheese into it, and it was just like, he flipped it and made an omelet out of it. And I was like, I didn't know you could do this, but I was like, wow, what are we eating? And he was like, this is an omelet. I'm like, an omelet? He's like, yeah, this is an omelet. And I was like, I need to eat this. I need to eat more of this. I like this. I don't know what you seasoned it with, but it was fantastic. And I loved it.
I think it's really special that matters because it was so rare that he would cook.
Yes, it was so rare that my dad would cook. But my dad, in a sense, was a foodie, was he not? Because he liked to eat. He liked to eat. And I've got early recognitions or memories of him taking us places. The first time I got a foot-long Polish was with my pops. The first time I got to eat steak was with my dad at the steakhouse that was off of Michigan Avenue over there. I can't think of it. It's still there. That was the first place I got to eat a steak, you know. And I remember the first time I got to eat the steak because I was like, I want a steak. He was like, yeah, okay, yeah, you're big enough to have a steak. And the look in his face was like, darn it, you know. But, you know, that, you know. And then the other thing I can say, and I started making omelets just from watching my father, with really no prior knowledge. And I can't say that the first colors I did ever, you know, turned out right or anything like that. But, you know, I was making omelets. I was standing up to the stove making omelets from then on. That was my thing, you know. So I was doing omelets. And then the next thing was with my mom's mom. I just remember one day I spent the night, and I don't know why she did it, but I don't really care because it was the greatest thing on the face of this planet. I got up that morning, and all I smelled was something that smelled like meat, hamburger meat cooking. And I was like, Grammy, what you doing? I called her mama. I said, Mama, what are you doing? She's like, I'm making Salisbury steak. I'm like, did I oversleep? Is it dinner time? And she's like, no, it's breakfast. I said, okay. And so she put down in front of me a plate of scrambled eggs, Salisbury steak on top of grits with gravy, pan gravy on top of that. That was the most greatest thing I have ever had in my entire life. And that, I mean, I've had.
She gave you the chopped wood breakfast. She gave you the chopped wood breakfast.
Yes, if we could, if there was wood to go chop, I would have been chopping it. If there was plow ground to go plow, I would have been plowing it. And it was the greatest thing on the face of the planet for me. And I was like, my mama don't cook like this. Why does she know how to do this? You know, what's going on with this? You know, where did this come from? What is this stuff called? And she's like, breakfast. This is what we eat. I didn't have sausage. You know, and see, Dennis, and these are the, and that's what grandmama did. And I just gotta just give me a few minutes more. My grandmother then later she made one thing one day. She was like, we're gonna have lunch, and I was like, all right, cool. She's like, I got hamburger buns. I mean, I got hot dog buns, but all I got is hamburger meat. She said, you know what we're gonna do? She's like, come here. She's like, come here. Take this hamburger. So she. Hamburger, she seasoned it up. She says, now roll it out to the shape of a hot dog. We rolled those hamburgers, rolled it out to the shape of a hot dog. We then covered them in bacon, rolled them, wrapped them in bacon, and then we cooked them off. And then we stuck them in the hamburger buns. We stuck them in the hot dog buns. So we had hamburgers rolled in bacon, stuck in hot dog buns that she then put cheese on top of. I was a little fat boy in fat boy heaven.
Man. All right.
I was in fat boy heaven. I was like, I'm not going home. I'm going to stay here with you, mama, because I am not going home. Never, ever again am I going back to my house. And needless to say, I learned a lot from her, because my grandmother, no shame in her game, she was a maid and she was a cook. And she had did like, I've never learned English in school. But anyway, She learned a lot of classical dishes. She was cooking these things at home because she cooked for a lot of people. She cooked for Greeks and she cooked for other people, and she did a lot of that. She cooked a lot, and she brought those dishes home, and she would put those things together for us. You know, I had chicken cacciatore, also known as Hunter's chicken. You know, never knew what that was. You know, and then she even explained to me where Hunter's chicken came from and why it's called chicken cacciatore, which is Hunter's chicken, and how it came from the hunters who were out and when they were hunting, and they would throw everything into a pot, whatever they could find, and it was Hunter's chicken. But we changed it to chicken cacciatore, which to me was just fried chicken and tomato sauce, which was like good. I mean, that was heaven rolling around in my mouth. That was heaven, you know.
Yep.
And needless to say, you know, the thing about when you talk about people asking you for recipes and how hard sometimes it is, it's like, well, you know, I don't even know how to explain a recipe to you sometimes, because I'm going to tell you how my mama explained it to me. Well, at the point, my grandmother, when she got sick, I went and stayed with her, and I was cooking dinner for her. And she would sit in a chair in the kitchen, and I would stand at the stove, and I would do whatever it is. And I would say, Grandmama, how much of this should I put in? She said, how much do you think you should put in? I said, I don't know. She said, well, taste the spice. Is it strong? Is it weak? Is it savory? How is it? Is it bitter? What does it taste like? And then I would tell her. And she says, well, then think of how much of that you want in your food and season your food accordingly. And that is how I learned spices, and that is how I learned to do that, and that's how I learned recipes. She was like, how much do you think is enough? You're cooking for four, you're cooking for six. This is how much you think you should have. This is how much you should do. She said, you're going to have to, you know, use the instincts that have been given to you. You know, put what you into. You think cumin and coriander will go together? And if so, what dish do you think they're going to go together in? How about tarragon and this, you know? So those are some of my earliest food memories. I'm sorry if I took too long on that one.
No, that's really cool. And to bring it back to the music notes, it sounds like to me that she was, you know, a jazz player. She was bebopping and scatting all over the place trying to get it to work. And you can't really write that music. You know, it doesn't make sense when you write that music down. It doesn't add up.
No. But the best thing is, if you've ever been in a kitchen, of course all three of us have, if you're an outsider looking in, you, the chef, are running an orchestra. But the only difference is it's a bunch of chaos to everybody that is standing around looking at, like, I don't know what's going on. But you, the chef, you, the cook, you, the one running it, you know what's going on. I need this, I need that, and you're hammering out. And you're telling everybody what their note they need to be playing and what they need to be doing. And it's chaotic, and I love it, and it's crazy. And that's one of the...
I think all chefs are chaos junkies, but the real chaos to me, we can plan everything out. We have all the right personnel in place. They have the right skills to get this orchestra moving. Everything is done until you open a door and the first customer that comes in brings all their chaos with them. Then it's a whole different thing. Because they're going to demand this or they're going to demand that, and you have no idea exactly which way your day is going to go until you open the doors to that customer.
Yeah, that is true. I think another thing you want to throw in there, if you want to talk about customers, I think is their expectation and knowledge does not match your expectation and knowledge. And I'm going to just give it to you. And
very
a real,
seldom.
Hmm?
Very seldom, no. You're right.
Yeah, I mean,
they want everything for nothing. They want champagne with Kool-Aid money, you know, stuff like that doesn't match. They don't understand what it is we do. Or like my mother-in-law used to have a problem babysitting for me because my hours were so long and it was, well, you don't need to stay at a job for 14 to 18 hours a day, and I'm like, yeah, actually, I do.
Yeah.
So, answer me this, David. Why did you seek out culinary, or did you kind of fall backwards into it?
I guess I was already into it. I used to sell cookies. I used to hustle cookies out of my gym bag and out of the back of the trunk of my car back in the 80s, you know, just to make cookies up, put them in those clear containers, put my pager number on them. So I used to actually hang out at Mendo, at the old house parties at Mendo in that parking lot by the pond. And people come out 1:32 o'clock in the morning, you know, after getting all sweaty up in that gym dancing, some oatmeal raisin cookies sound right about right, don't they? So $3.
What year was that? Because
that was 1987, around there.
I might have bumped into you then in 86.
Quite possible. I could help carry in Ron Hardy's crates, and then when I got done, I started hawking my cookies. Now, I used to hawk it in the hallways in the high school and around Inglewood. I was known as the Cookie King of Inglewood, the Foes and the Moes. It was like, he's straight, you know. Even though they're rival gang members, I was good with them because I gave them cookies, gave the cops cookies.
You got it.
teachers cookies. I also found out that the girls, you know, when I start liking the girls, I found out that the girls like the cookies. So I said, this is a great quid pro quo. You want to go out and see Breaking Five? You know, I got some cookies. So I was making it work to my advantage. Now, my mom, of course, me not having a job in high school, but I have all the Fresh Starter jackets. You know, I used to go to Herman Sport in Evergreen Plaza and buy that new starter jacket when it would come out. I had every college on, and I had money in my pocket. She, of course, thought I was probably doing something illegal. And when she came to have her intervention, I took her to the basement kitchen. We lived in a bi-level, and I showed her my operations. Like, Mom, I've been baking. I guess you assume the house smells like brown sugar and butter all the time. And she didn't, you know, then she realized my son is like a little entrepreneur, but, you know, we got to help him know this. My mom was a professor at Chicago State, and she was tutoring a executive chef of a restaurant in Andersonville, and she asked the person if, you know, he would be my mentor. So I had to travel all the way to Andersonville. So from like 87 through 89, I saw a whole different world outside of Burnside area or Grisham area or Inglewood, for that matter, where all my friends were kind of stuck on those corners. I saw a whole different life on another side of town, and, you know, Swedish cuisine. It was crazy. It was interesting. But I got involved in that route, and, you know, he says, well, you know, you're doing all this, you ought to think about going to culinary school. So from there, I went to Kendall College. I thought I was doing something special because Kendall College at that time was in Evanston, and mm-hmm. was up in the shadows of Northwestern. So it felt like I was going to a high. Well, it wasn't as expensive yet then. You know, that was back in 89. Culinary school wasn't popular. You know, TV network and all these other things have made culinary schools go through $60,000-$80,000 for your associate's degree. I went to Kendall.
Yeah.
Kendall wasn't more than $8,000. And even though in 89, that was a lot of money, because my Chicago State degree only cost $13,000 by comparison, you know, a bachelor's at that time. But still, I went there, got it over with, learned what I could learn. It's been a lot of fun, made a lot of networks and contacts, but I also learned that I was a very lone in the kitchen, and we probably would talk about that down the road, being the only African-American in a lot of kitchens full of Mexicans or, you know, strange white people. I found myself very alone in culinary school. I found myself alone on all sorts of lines that I had to, you know, when you heard your parents say, you got to be two times, three times as much, I got to perform better than you guys. I got to, you know, I got to take ownership of this grill. I got to command this saute line. You know, I'm going to ask the chef, can I do profit loss statements with him on a Monday? He ain't got to pay me. I learned that from the chef that mentored me. He says, the ones that make the money are the ones that manage the people. So he says, you know, there's players and there's pawns. He said, choose to be the player, and everyone in this kitchen is going to become your pawn. And he just said, how you position yourself is in management. And that's where I started learning how to do all the lines, all the things that need to be done to make the dishes come out, so I can let people know, if you know, you don't want to do it, I can do it. I can fire you. I'll do it for a minute, but I want to hire somebody else to do this in the kitchen. But, you know, that's what I learned a long time ago about that from the chef in Andersonville. So,
awesome.
But you know, being the only black person.
Yeah, I've had similar and add on to it that I'm a girl. So, you know, I would find myself.
You got a double rough, yeah.
Right, you know.
Yeah.
First couple of weeks in the kitchen, there was always that moment where, like, the guys would, like, gang up to, okay, let's see what she's made out of. And most of the time that was verbal. So they start telling dirty jokes or say something salacious to see if it would make me mad. And always I would give just as good as they could give me. I'd send it back to them and stand flat foot. And they were like, oh, wait a minute. And
they don't know your mama and daddy.
Well, yeah, they don't know where I come from.
They don't know who our parents are. So no.
Right.
Yeah.
But I tell a lot of females in my culinary program, like, you know, a lot of them are very, very attractive and very small and petite. I'm like, you got to come up with a really bad, dirty joke that is, like, so raunchy, and that will make dudes be like, oh my God, I got to go to the back room for a minute. Did you just say
right.
that? You know, and I said, just go ahead and say that. If you like men and you like it like this, say that to them, and that would shut them the hell up. They would be like, oh, my God, because they're talking about women and objectifying women. Going ahead and objectify a man in an all-male-dominated kitchen, they'll shut up. Matter of fact, they'll probably start doing the work for the woman. They'll be like, let me do that for you, girl. You
right.
sexy.
Oh, my God, yeah. When
yeah,
I
you
started
can start
at the Palmer House, I was still at Roosevelt, so I want to say that was 92 maybe. Yeah, I brought that. One of my professors at Roosevelt was the food and beverage director at the Palmer House, and I impressed him or whatever, and he asked me, where are you working? And I told him. He was like, nah, uh-uh. Meet me in my office on Wednesday. I had no idea he meant come, and I'm going to have you interview with the chef. That's all he said. Meet me in my office. I was like, okay. Luckily, I did put on something cute, And this was back in the day when I was 115 pounds soaking wet and 22 years old. So I show up and everybody's like, you know, during the tour, I'm getting all these whispers behind me. Oh, see that? Oh, what's she here for? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, oh, no, here we go. And, you know, the Ponder House at one point had 45 chefs on the morning shift. You know, we were getting down, and I had to make sure, no, I'm not here for play. I am serious about this, and I didn't get the job because I was cute. You had to get past that preconceived notion of she's the chef's pet or potential girlfriend and all of that just to be able to do your job.
Yeah,
I think you had to overcome some things that I didn't have to deal with because I'm not cute. So
yeah, wow. He said he's not cute. Wow.
I'm not currently deadly and adorable. So that doesn't. I just,
yeah. Nah, I hear you. But down here in Atlanta, having a job makes you cute. But anyway, for a lot of guys, yeah, it does. But I know for me, some of my experiences are like very different. You know, I had never had any intentions on doing what I'm doing. And it was the last thing and the furthest thing from my mind. But I just got into it actually by a whim. And when I got down here in 93. I got down here in 93, and see, I had just got through taking the Chicago police exam, so I was really waiting on that. I was going to follow my father's footsteps and become a police officer in Chicago, but it took them, well, yeah, I kind of am too. It took them 4 years to grade our test and get our test back to us. And by that time, I had graduated culinary school, had my second child, and was working as a executive chef in one of the first in one of my first kitchens, making more than their starting salary. So my dad, he said, you know, he's like, should I just like throw this away or what? I was like, yeah, you can, you know. But my first experiences into this, they were a little bit different. I mean, they're still, you would think, okay, everybody's coming to Atlanta. This is supposed to be the promised land for a lot of blacks, and everybody's, you know, going to, you know, do well. But a lot of opportunity. I saw none of that. Now, when I graduated culinary school and I got to, when I went to culinary school, let's start there. When I went to culinary school, now, it wasn't really any type of, it wasn't about racism, it was about sex there, in a sense of I had female and male teachers, and it seems like the female teachers felt like they had like they demanded more respect out of us because, you know, like, yeah, because they had something to prove, they were females, or, you know, because like one of my first my production one teachers, man, she spent the first 15 minutes on her whole accolades of what she did to get to where she was, what she opened and what she, you know, this, that, and the other. And me, I didn't really care. You don't impress me, you know, like that with your accolades. I want to see what you do, you know, but I give you respect because you are the head chef of this school, in which she was, and you are my teacher. So I give you accolades on that. You know, you don't have to try to do that with, yeah.
But, you know, what I resent stuff like that because what you did in the field and what you did in the classroom are hardly ever the same. Are you a good teacher? I don't care if you got papers and letters behind your name.
Right, neither do I.
If you got to show me on the bench some stuff that I have not seen before and be able to effectively teach it to me. And with me teaching the populations that I'm currently teaching, they seldom know anything about my career unless they specifically ask me, because I'm about getting you to improve yourself, not about impressing you.
Okay. Yeah, but see, okay, so what I'm saying is I understand, right, I'm all for, when we were in school, it's the same thing. Like I said, she spent 15 minutes telling me about what she opened and what she closed. I'm just like, you're eating up 15 minutes of my hour that I'm paying you for to teach me. Just teach me, you know. Just teach me, you know. And that's what I want to know. I don't really care. I mean, so you opened the Hilton, you this. All of that is impressive. But see, that's a lot of what it's about. A lot of this is bravado. It's about, well, I've done this. I can puff my chest out. I mean, I had another teacher who had to show me that he was on the culinary team for one of the Olympic culinary teams in the baking and pastry teacher. All right. So he had to show us all of his work. But it's like, how does that translate into the classroom? I need you to teach me what you're doing there. You know,
right.
But he had got to the point. Now, this he got to the point that he was like, I really don't care whether you all learn or not. My father-in-law is paying for me to is funding me to open up a restaurant in downtown Decatur. I was like, well, then maybe you should get somebody here that should teach us and should care. But I mean, these are the this is some of the attitudes that we dealt with, you know. And then, you know, teachers hitting on students, you know, the cute little girls getting hit on, and you know. Now, I did run across one chef, though, that I thought was pretty cool. His name was Chef Chairs. And one day he's in my production class. One day he's doing my baking and pastry class. One day he's doing my sanitation class. So I just walked up to him. I said, dude, how is it that you get to teach me all of these things? He said, I'm going to give you a bit of advice. He said, I've got a piece of paper that says I'm certified in everything that I'm doing up here. He said, now, as a young black man coming into this business, he said, you need to learn everything that you can learn, because you'll see when you get to interviewing with these people down here that he said, Alan, your name is going to get you in the door, but the color of your skin is going to possibly get you back out the door and not get that job. And I was like, really? I didn't think that was like prevalent in 1996. But he was like, but when they tell you, but he said when they tell you, oh, I needed somebody who's certified in this, he said, I pull out my piece of paper and show them. He said, I make it hard for them to deny me the job. They have to work at telling me they can't give me the job. Now, when I graduated culinary school, I ran into a lot of that. It was the first time I ever heard, when I walked in for a job, I heard somebody once tell me, you're overqualified. I'm like, say what? He says, yeah, you're overqualified. He said, we're just looking for, you know, cooks to just come in and cook on the grill and do this, that, and the other. And I was like, well, you know, I can do that. And he was like, well, okay, it's not so much. He says, you are overqualified. He said, but he said, you're going to be bored to death because we just do, you know, comfort food. And I was like, well, I can do comfort food. You know, dude, I just spent all this money trying to.
That notion of being overqualified bugs me, because if I'm applying for your position and you advertise the position as it is and we're truthful about it, did you ever think that I need to shore up my economy? I'd rather be bored at work and not homeless than homeless and overqualified. So that irritates the mess out of me. But let's go back to the subject of food education. I need to hear some more from our guest, David, about what do you do for CPS and where is it heading, considering that we have a strike potential going on?
Well, you know, the strike is going to be what the strike is going to be. I support the teachers and what their endeavors are. I mean, I'm non-union full-time at CPS because I'm an administrator. You know, the morale around the district is very low. I'm seeking myself some sort of happiness. You know, I mean, my main happiness is really making sure that students are, are connecting and breaking a lot of cycles. But it's really hard on a daily basis when so many appointed people are appearing in the hallways that the mayor has hired or the CEO has hired, and then you're seeing these salaries of, like, you know, enormous gap in salaries, $180,000, $220,000, and, you know, you think about the work, like, you know, you laugh at my title, but it is a lot of work, you know. And I look at what they do, and I'm like, you sit in the office every day drinking a Starbucks, and then you have a long lunch, and then you know, I'm like, what do you do? And I get to that point that I came to CPS not really for the money in the beginning, because I was fairly successful in my restaurant ventures in the past. I did it for stability for my family life because of, you know, I'm married with twins and I want to spend more time with my children. And also I saw the opportunity to upgrade these old schools. I mean, I'm in the underserved schools. I'm not at the Whitney Youngs or the Walter Paytons. I'm in the Fingers. I'm in the Simeons. I'm in the Chicago Vocationals. I'm in schools that students that attend those schools need something else. They need more. And so I use that as my ministry. But one thing that is getting hard is the financial stress and burden that a lot of people that are in the education system that are trying to play educator are messing up. And you know, the money that's been given away and stolen from the district, you know, in the forms of pensions by a bunch of the 1% and 2%. I mean, I'm very vocal about it, but, you know, our governor has $150 million he got from the pension 5 years ago. He's never paid it back. A lot of rich people have borrowed from, quote-unquote, borrowed from the CPS pension and have never paid it back. And until someone really brings that up, that's why I say I support the teachers, and, you know, I think taxpayers should also sue. Why do we have to make up for those that rich and overpaid people have given away, made bad, poor, they made poor business decisions, and, you know, now it's costing the district, you know, is billions of dollars in debt because you hired these people that said, well, I know how to make the CPS system work. And I'm like, but you didn't. You know, you made it go further in debt. Now we have a CEO in the system right now that's like, well, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, and I don't care what it does to the middleman. He's kind of like what the governor is in the state right now.
Right.
Our diverse learners are suffering because he cut out that whole department almost. And so now the teachers have to learn to be better coaches in diverse learning, but they don't have anybody to help them and support them with it. But that's what I'm doing right now as a director. It's like, well, let me try to fill that void. After they made those recent cuts a couple of weeks ago, I'm trying to see where can I help support my teachers to fill voids at for them, you know, because a lot of our students are changing. A lot of the things they're dealing with are things that neither one of us have dealt with in our youth. We didn't have to deal with going to a bunch of funerals and, you know, your friends, so many friends have died and gunfire is like normal to them.
You know,
when Benji Wilson got shot at Simeon, the whole city stopped.
Oh my God,
teenagers didn't get shot, but when he got shot, everybody was like, he got shot with a gun. You might have gotten beaten up with a stick or a bat or a chain, but you never got shot.
No,
that's normal. That is secondary to breathing to today's youth. So teachers are dealing with a lot. I will hope that maybe they will come up with a solution and there won't be a strike because we got a lot of things this year still to do with the students in my programs.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, if they strike, I'll support them, but I'm hoping that they can come to some resolution. But it's pretty bleak right now, CPS, you know?
Yeah.
The charter schools are being misused as a solution, and it's not a solution. Charter schools are supposed to be, you know, you open up, it's a study lab, let's trade out some best practices of how to deliver curriculum in a way to a set of students. But again, here comes the 1% and the 2% going, man, we could profit from this. So let's brainwash everybody and make everybody feel that charter schools across the nation should replace public schools. And if you look at the numbers, you look at the outcomes, charter schools are doing no better than CPS schools. They cherry pick, you know, and that's a big alarming thing when they do that because they're really doing a disservice to the youth. And I got a big problem with that. So, again, all I can say is from what we're doing, you know, we try to give them some skilled hands. Kids can come out with a certification in our public school programs, but charter schools can't say kids are getting industry-level certifications. And, you know, I'm very competitive now when I'm drawing a line in the sand with them about it, you know?
Yeah. You're quite vocal on social media about these issues. Now, my experience, when my oldest was old enough to go to kindergarten, first grade, and stuff like that, we enrolled her at MedCap. And while she is an exceptional student, I'm getting tongue-tied here, he was in the advanced program there. I was extremely disheartened when we would go to a school event and see the vast difference between the kids that were in her advanced program and the kids in the rest of the population. And I knew at some point we'd have to pull her from that population in order to nurture her gifted intellect. And I went and put her in a charter school and went through all the, you know, headaches of getting back and forth because it was way out of our neighborhood. But for us, it worked. They're out throughout the suburbs, and we have a different school district, and all three of my kids have been thriving really well outside of CPS. So sometimes when I hear you talk about charter schools, my experience with it was really different. So I just can only kind of look at it from my own viewpoint. You see more of it than I do.
Well, I'm not saying that all garbage. It's just that charter that you might have seen, charter elementary schools, a lot of them do it right. Charter high schools, it's rough because in secondary school, that is a very, very delicate point in any young child's life. You
Absolutely.
Know, when you become a teenager, you're starting to smell yourself, your puberty, all these things are blowing up inside your body.
Yeah.
It's changing. You want to date, social circle things happen. Secondary education, that is a very, very vital. You can go in either direction. You could have been a very promising young kid in elementary, and if the high school part isn't correct, bam, it can all go downhill. So I'm really, when I talk about a lot of charters, I'm pointing out a lot of high school charters, okay? Elementary charters, I see, are doing a good thing, and when there's a need to improve our early childhood and our elementary schools, especially the CPS. The problem in the public schools is all they want to do is test, prepare for this test. There's six different tests in CPS elementary schools. Charters aren't doing that. Charters are actually able to teach. The average public school teacher in an elementary school doesn't have time to actually teach a kid something. They're too busy preparing them for the test. So too many companies that are saying, hey, make this, you need this standardized test, and then they add it in, but they don't take it away. I feel if the teachers are going to strike, and I know that is on the plate, they want to reduce some of these standardized tests, and that's why, again, I support them. Reduce some of these tests down. When we went to school, there was only two. Remember that? The Iowa test, and then there was the midterm test. Just two. There's six tests in the public school system right now. That's a lot of testing. And so that's a major problem, and that's one thing that CPS schools are too busy dealing with, and until they address that. But if you go to elementary charter school, then you got a chance to level the playing field. And I agree with you. My children are in a selective enrollment elementary school. They're in Skinner. And I had to chop off my left arm to get my kids in that school. Okay?
Yes.
And there's a difference between the neighborhood component and the gifted component, right? And then you got parents who are in a neighborhood school. They want their kids in the gifted component. I'm like, they got to test in to be near my kids. And again, when we went to school, you had at level, above level, and below level in each grade. They never mixed them. But now there's a law that got passed in which you have to mix the kids together in the same grades, you know. And then the way they alleviated that was opening up selective enrollment schools or gifted programs. And there is a huge divide between just regular track, you know, school, quote unquote, and the gifted program schools. Like you saw it yourself when your child was at Metcalf. You saw this huge difference. You know, but let's take that on to high school. We have teenagers that didn't go to gifted. We have the No Child Left Behind law, which is a bunch of crap. They pass them on. We have teenagers that can't tell time. You have teenagers that can't do basic algebra. You know, I asked a kid, there's 32 ounces in a quart. There's 4 quarts in a gallon. How many ounces in 3 gallons? And the kid was like, huh? I'm like, you're 17 years old. You can work the question out. You can talk a girl out of her panties, but you can't do simple math.
Or better yet, you can read. Now, I was going to say, or better yet, you can repeat all the rap lyrics to some of these, one of these old crazy rap videos, but you can't do that.
I was actually going to say that next. When I talk to a lot of students, I bring it to the point, and I bring this to them. I say, you can do all this, but you can't do these basic things. But it's because the parents haven't given them that base when they were young, and it just proliferated. It's like a snowball on the top of the mountain. It got bigger and bigger and bigger. And we see a lot of that right now. And, I mean, this is another reason why I got involved in CPS, so I could say this isn't, you know, they're not really taking advantage of what education can bring to them, but can I find a way to make something engaging to them and empower them in a career pathway? And that's another reason I came into the district, for that reason, because I saw this happening with students. You know, so you may not go to college because you – yeah.
Well, listen to this. So I'm teaching at a community center, and it's connected to a Noble school. Great program, all the rest of it. I'm teaching class, and we're going over nutritional information, and I said, hey, come on, read this paragraph for me. This is I have a class for 6th through 8th grade. The 6th grader says, no, I don't read. I said, no, we read here. He was like, no, you can call my mama. I don't read. Then I had him come to my classroom, and come to find out, he didn't mean that he refuses to read. He meant that
he can't read.
Grade, he can't read.
Right, but call my mama because my mama's getting $250 extra. But my mama's getting $250 extra because I got an IEP, so she gets a slow check. You know about that?
Okay.
The mother makes if she's on welfare, she can get $250 extra because a child has been tested as having an IEP, an individualized education program, okay? So she makes extra money is supposed to go towards helping him become a better person, helping him to learn, you know, go get some extra training, extra tutoring.
Right, overcome
the debt. But they'll probably use it for something else. Now,
for years,
he has turned in, I can't call my mama. But this is a high school bound kid that's telling you this, right?
Yeah.
Here's the other tragic part. Noble will accept that kid in their high school, and then they'll bring him into the high school, they'll chew him up, they'll spit him out, they'll kick him back out to a CPS neighborhood school. And I got a kid with a broken spirit, and he still can't read, but he also got kicked out of Noble's high school after they grabbed some money from him sitting in the seat for 20 days. There's a lot of politics and reality that goes on between how people are utilizing education for personal financial gain, and it's terrible.
Yeah.
You know.
All right, we got about
so true.
Hang on, guys. We got about 20 minutes left in the broadcast, and just want to get that out there. If anybody wants to call in, I gave the number out a lot at the beginning, but it's 657-383-0717. Even if we don't get any callers, I'm digging this conversation.
The conversation did get a little deep and militant, I can tell that much.
I don't disagree that it should. I don't think it shouldn't. You know what I'm saying? My father and my mother at one point were hippies, and then my mother married my brother's father, and now we're all, you know, the Brady Bunch, that kind of thing. But asking the question was something that I learned how to do really early. I wasn't a kid that was seen and not heard. That wasn't me. And then a lot of the time I spent, you know, before I was hung out with kids, I hung out with adults. I learned things that they knew. And so confronting an issue, I'm all for that. The art of debate has been lost in this nation, and I blame George Bush and his whole concept of you're either with us or against us. It's not patriotic or it is patriotic. And no, the art of debate is about you take one side, I take the other side. Let's knowledgeably talk about the subject to figure out what it's all about. And we don't do that anymore. It's this whole adversarial idea of I know what's right, and if you don't agree, go to hell.
And that's the thing of where that's the thing he said. George Bush did away with civic education, and civic education is what helped you get free range thought to go, hey, well, explain to me your angle and your side. Okay, let me explain to you my angle and my side. Okay, where do we agree on in the middle, and where are we not ever going to agree on ever? And that's debate, right? You know, how can I win you over to see my side? But civic education has been gone for close to what, almost over 20 years since he was president. I'm talking about the father George Bush from before Clinton. All right, and so we've gotten rid of it. Now they're talking about bringing civic education back to the public school system in this country, some new avant-garde, state-of-the-art thing going on. But I'm like, wow, y'all took it away. George Bush also tried to get rid of the vocational education, what I'm directing right now. Right. He tried to get rid of it. But, I mean, we went underground, but, I mean, now we're talking about it again. A lot of people think that CPS has gotten rid of vocational education those 20 years ago. And I said, no, they've been around. It's just that they don't allow to promote what we do. And I tell people, you don't know about the millions of dollars of scholarships I give out unless I shoot a kid. You might hear about it. You won't hear about the success stories of what we do in CPS. So, I mean, that's another reason I said, well, I'll take this radio interview because you never know who's listening. Let's get the word out. We got something that's so good in CPS. Damn, you didn't even know it existed, you know? And that's the type of reason why, you know, I'll talk at churches. I'll talk at anti-violence convention rallies. I talk at all sorts of things about this is what's good in the hood for real. Here's the outcomes. You can see it. You can smell it. Hey, you can even taste it. And that's what I try to bring out to say this is what I could do with your child if you send them to this school. In 3 years, we could laugh about this. But with the parental support and with the team of teachers that I've helped bring on into the system, we got a lot of people that are ready to engage your kid, treat them like extended family, help them overcome a lot of these obstacles that are going on in their lives to see that there is a brighter future outside of and past their high school years if they hang with us. And that's what one thing we're really doing a good job trying to integrate with a lot of our kids.
Yeah.
But I wanted to add something to you guys. May 6th, the culinary students are doing their annual capstone.
Yep.
And this year we are going to celebrate the 100th centennial of the Great Migration. I think it's something that needs to be celebrated in American history, that, you know, 1916, African-American folks decided, I'm leaving the South, no more Jim Crow, no more getting lynched in the middle of the night, no more getting, you know, talked to by white people. We're going to go north. But they brought culture, different food, different approaches to how plates are done from Carolinas all the way to Arizona, Mississippi cuisine, you know, Louisiana, of course, you know, has a hodgepodge from all the different cultures that are melted into Louisiana, the Portuguese, Spanish, French, the Arcadians. What they do in their pots? What do they do in Asheville, Carolina? What they do there? And so the students of CPS will be doing a study on this southern food, our southern food ways, be it through storytelling, food sampling, a study on different barbecue sauce, you know, tomato-based, vinegar-based, white sauce. The history of the rip tip. I tell people rip tips are Chicago barbecue.
Oh,
you know, Kansas has their, they got their burnt ends, you know, and Memphis has their ribs. The rip tip is Chicago's quintessential barbecue because when black people came to Chicago, they went to the stockyards, and they were throwing away that gristle meat. They cut it off, keep the ribs, and they were throwing it on a pile, and a bunch of people got together and said, man, we eat this down in Mississippi. We've been eating this. And made these barbecue aquarium pits, what limbs being the last one in the city, in which they slow-cooked that gristle meat, chopped it up, and now they sell it for, what, $14 for a pound? You know.
Oh, yeah.
But, right. But that is something that we can talk about that is historical fact. Fried chicken. Germany is claiming that they invented fried chicken. Now, in Germany, they do fry meat in oil, but who's the ones that's crusting the meat? They just fry the meat in oil. They don't season it. They don't flour it. We got to get to the base of who invented fried chicken without sounding, oh, let's let the black people claim it. But if we want to claim it, let's claim it. You know, black eyed peas, a story about black eyed peas. So all these would be talked about and enjoyed on that date on May 6th. And, you know,
that's
anyone that
wonderful.
Hears this blog, yeah, come
and
on out to Washburn, and they'll all be there. It's going to be a great celebration.
I love it. I love it intensely because on my mother's side of the family, I am one of two people born north of the Mason-Dixon line. I am an inheritor of exactly what you're talking about. Both of my grandparents came out of Yorktown and Newport News, Virginia. I used to go back every year. So it's, yes. Oh, I'm almost stoked about that. I wish I could get in.
Right, but I do ask, like, people who are, you know, to the students at all the schools, like, find a great uncle or a great auntie. What was it like when they first moved to Chicago? Or what was it like where they came from? Mm-hmm. You know, so what did they bring with them food-wise? But there's a lot of stories to be told over a pot of something. You know, over how, you know, this dish we made in our family, what's exclusive in your family, what's beloved in my family. And actually finding a way to share that in you know, a couple of bites at a table. So that's what the subject's going to be about. It's going to be interesting.
All right.
Sounds great.
14 more minutes. So what I'm going to do for the last bit of this is I'm going to pose one question, and I'm going to give both of my gentlemen an opportunity to answer. And we're going to start with David. How can we, as culinarians, help to heal and stop the violence that we are seeing in Chicago's streets?
Well, again, I mentioned that's why I took this job at Chicago Public Schools is, and I talk about this at Violence Things, is if you're able to show any human growth, you know, I met you this month, and then 2 months later, now we did an assessment, and you now have a certification. You now know how to break a chicken down. You now know how to price out items. You now, you work at this event or at that event, you got some exposure to something. Empowering youth is a great way to, you know, help them curb, like, you know, I'm less to want to do something stupid because I can see that I can actually do something and be something. A lot of our people that are very violent right now are growing up in households that, you know, they weren't loved when they were in the womb. They weren't loved when they were birthed. You know, some of them told they were a mistake. Some of them were told that, you know, we'll curse that and cuss that. You see parents that will talk to their kids and call them, you know, little bad MFs and stuff like this. That is taking a toll out of so many kids that they grew not to love themselves. If I don't love myself and I don't respect myself, then why do I care about you? And, you know, and so working on them, learning how to work with critical thinking, and that we integrate that in the curriculum as well, to, you know, that when it comes to problems, that they can see through the problems and go, you know what, I don't need to fight. I don't need to act out. I don't need to do this. Let me just go home because I got this big culinary event tomorrow, you know, or I got this big, I want to show everybody my welding project. Now, I'm not saying that my solution is 100%, but I've seen a lot of kids change their lives and decide that they want to do something different. You know, and they realize they're doing something different that a lot of their other friends are not doing. And they got supportive adults, you know, unlike the adults they've been around most of their early lives. We try with the adults that are with them to say, hey, you know, we're with you. What do you want to do? You know, we'll give you all this for free. What do you want to do? And so that's one thing that I feel that to work with it, to combat the violence that's going on in the city is to start, you know, letting people know these programs exist. Putting them in some type of adult workforce program, the same what we're doing in high schools, those need to be developed. So I'm looking at churches as well. Like, you know, churches have a lot of money. They have the ability to put together those programs and help with these adults, these young adults that are also parents, to help them.
Please leave your message for...
Oh, sorry.
What's that?
Alan?
My brother's phone line had dropped out. I was trying to get him back in.
Okay. Yeah. So, getting them to see through their lives. And once they can see through their lives, you know, that's empowering them. They want to see, I got this next level going on. you know, I don't think I think I want to do. I'm gonna go the other direction. I see my friends are gonna do something crazy. I realize this isn't it for me. So that's one thing. That's how I, you know, bring a solution to as many tables as I sat on. Like, you know, we need to find a way to get the word out about what we do in our school system.
Give me just a second. Let's see if we can get him back online.
Okay.
Hello.
Oh, wonderful. Good. All right. Cool.
Alan's back. Okay.
Yep. By the way, Alan, you do realize in the family I was blamed for your culinary education. You know that, right?
Say that again. What?
You know, I got blamed for your culinary education.
How did you get blamed?
Because I graduated first, I went and did it first, and then everybody was like, what are you saying to your brother? Like, what did you do to convince him? I'm like, I had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, no, my father should take the blame, and then my grandmother, and then my mother. So, but you know what? Let's be honest. All right, here's the thing, and this is something I think that we lack in what we do. We lack honesty. We lack truthfulness and we lack honesty. We want to tell people what they want to hear. I'm not for that. I'm going to tell you what you need to know. I'm going to tell you the truth. If you don't like the truth, I'm sorry, but it's the truth. I'm not going to tell you how I feel, because how I feel may not be the truth. And so
And how I feel is likely to change.
Right, and how I feel is likely to change. And just because I feel a certain way don't mean it's right or wrong. It's just how I feel. So when I talk to the youth or when I talk to people, I tell them what I know to be fact from what I have experienced. And everybody's experiences are different. But I think we need to tell people the truth. I'm not for this PC stuff. I'm not for that. You want to be politically correct? Okay, fine, you do that. And I can understand that. But sometimes we need to hear the truth. And as long as I give it to you in love and not in anything else other than love, then it's just what it is. It's the truth. Now, truth being told, I went to Mendel Catholic High School. When you went to Mendel Catholic High School, you were expected to come out of there and to be somebody. Now, I am not going to tell you anything other than the fact that I was never told growing up what I could and could not be or what I could and could not do. All right? I was just at high school, and that's how I felt. And I you know my record at Mendel and how I came out.
Yeah.
You know, and I came out top 10%, all that good stuff. And when I went to the counselors, and I had never met the counselors. I mean, I've seen them in the hallway, didn't know they were counselors, that type of stuff. So when I went to the counselors and my final 2 weeks of school, and I asked them about a career path and what to do, this, that, and the other, he's like, I don't know you. Go to military. That's the first thing out of his mouth is you should join the military. I was like, I'm not about to go fight nobody's war and die for somebody who I don't know. I don't understand that. Now, don't get me wrong, because I got nothing against, and I applaud the men and women in this country who have gone and fought in for America. I applaud you on that. But for me, just say, I didn't see a point in it. I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I don't think the military is what I want to do either. And there's this thing, I got this thing against bullets. I don't know if it's just me, but I got a thing against bullets.
Okay.
I'm not for them, all right? So I'm not going to the military. So I was like, all right. So I sat around, and it was like, okay, well, you're going to college, all right? So I'm going to go to college. I wound up at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, all right?
But
they didn't want us there.
This important part here. I always tell the kids I'm in charge of or teaching or mentoring that seemed to be the biggest thing for me was the fact that we were never spoke to in terms of if you go to college. That was never the sentence in our house. Our house was when you go to college.
Right.
I don't
and
care
it is
if
true.
You major in ditch digging, you are going to go to college.
True enough, and that's how it was.
A lot of the kids that are in my population don't think about it, haven't thought about it, didn't think it was an opportunity, none of that. So I spend time like, what do you want to do with your life? I don't know.
Yeah, but what? Okay, now let's be realistic. Take a look at black culture, all right? What we call black culture. Show me an exonerated doctor. Show me an exonerated lawyer other than Johnny Cochran. Show me an engineer. Show me a teacher. Show me somebody other than the local sport hero, somebody other than the local rap artist, somebody other than the local twerking woman on the radio, on TV, who is doing something in our in this world. We do not know that we have black engineers that are millionaires. We have a black.
We know. Do
right,
they
but our kids. Right, no, but they don't know. They don't know. But my son knew. Now let's ask why my son knows. Because we made a point. We made a point to tell my son. Now my son went and daughter went to a school, and it's named after Martin Luther King. It is three blocks down the street from me, so they walked every day to school. This is one of the crappiest high schools here in Georgia, and I don't care, but it's one of the crappiest high schools here in Georgia. They cared about nothing but winning a football championship. All right, my son joined the engineering team, the robotics engineering team, his freshman year. There was only three black males in this whole thing, but the whole school is full of black males. But there's only three black boys, one on baseball team, one on the football team. And they were interested in engineering. Their idea, it's kind of like the Jets when I was in high school. But they build robots, they go to competitions, they compete against other schools, and so forth. Now, there's only three of them, and he's a freshman. There's only three of them on the team. I go to one of their first competitions. I'm the only father of any of the boys that went. Now it's a whole group. It's a whole group of them.
Yeah, I don't want to cut you off. We only have 3 minutes left, and
okay, then let me put it to you.
Go ahead, real quick.
No, just put it to you like this. We need to let our kids know there's something more than just music and slinging dope on the corner and all of that in this world.
Yeah, I agree. And for the last couple of minutes we have on this broadcast, we've touched upon a lot of really big issues, and an outsider who don't know us may not have think that we actually do a lot of talking about food, but everything in our lives has that touch of culinary because it's a daily activity for anybody who's breathing. You have to eat. You have to find nourishment. You have to do these things. So it gets expanded by definition when you talk about and look at the entire world. It is vital. We've all pretty much said that in different spheres. It is vital to have adult interaction in a positive manner in the lives of these children. And I wish that my kids and finger, when we try to do an ice cream social, and I say invite your families, they can come for this session, nobody shows up. Nobody's there. It's really a mark for me between the generations. I honestly believe that you can't give away what you don't have, and I honestly believe you can't teach what you don't know. However, when you put your child in an educational program, they're supposed to start learning what you don't have to give. It has been wonderful. We got 1 minute. It's been wonderful talking with you, gentlemen. I'm so glad we got to do this. Hopefully, the three of us will get to do it again sometime soon. This is the first time my big brother acted as a host with me, and I'm really happy for that. And, yes, I do realize I haven't put up the interview I did with you, big brother, yet because I wanted to do something with it first. And I will definitely get that up really, really soon. Thanks for listening. This is Giant Fork and Spoon. You can get us on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and a couple other outlets. And please take a look at the written companion on Blogger of the same name. Giant Fork and Spoon really had a touchstone in my heart, and I hope it touched you as well. Thanks for listening, and we'll be on again next weekend.
Peace.
Peace. Later.
Later. Thanks, guys.
Really? You're welcome, David.